Accession number 12910, Reel 8.
Mr. Imre, Reel 8.
It was urgent government policy in totally good faith to persuade the farmers that diseased trees ought to be cut out. This was seized upon by those who wanted to stir up as much trouble as possible as being a ploy on the part of government for some purposes of its own. And it was government's policy was discredited right through the country by these people who were trying to foment bother. And indeed, these parties of administrative officers had to be accompanied by fairly strong police escorts in order to prevent them being attacked. And the situation was getting more and more difficult. So that was yet another factor which occurred, which added to these other factors of general unsettlement, which I've just referred to. Finally, much of the trade in West Africa, and particularly in the Gold Coast, was in the hands of the United Africa Company and the Syrians, the Lebanese people. And prices were regarded as being beyond the range, prices of ordinary foodstuffs were regarded as being beyond the range of many Africans. Gone were the days when Africans would be content to eat locally grown food, yams, cassava, plantains, and so on. But they had become addicted to imported food, and they were not happy with the prices that appertained in stores run by the United Africa Company, by G.B. Ollivant, who were also one of the premier traders in the coast, and by some of the Greek firms, and by the Lebanese. And it was in beginning of 1948 that a boycott of these stores was carried out by Africans. It was total, and it was extremely successful. If anybody were ever to say, and there were people who said Africans couldn't organize, they certainly organized themselves over this boycott with very great skill. Admittedly, there were strong-arm men who formed themselves into bands to make quite sure that the boycott was enforced. And this would be carried out so far as possible without the police being there. When the police, the efforts were made by the police to make sure that these strong-arm tactics didn't work, and if the law was being broken, then the police would have to take action. But it was very, very difficult to enforce the law. These strong-arm people produced a climate of fear in the markets, and the result was that nobody, no African, dared go into the European or the Syrian-owned stores, Lebanese-owned stores. And so that was all these various factors early in 48 added up to a very considerable total of unease, if you understand me. I expect there are other factors, but those are the ones that come most clearly to my own mind. I had come down from the north, from a tour in the north, just before Christmas, 47. I had had a very, very pleasant year in the north, and the commissioner had come up there round about November and told me something about the climate of affairs in Accra and in the south, and he told me that he wanted me to come and take command of the police in Accra. I was by then a fairly senior superintendent. In fact, I think I was the number two superintendent of in the force. So, unhappily, because I enjoyed the north, I came down shortly before Christmas, 47, and there in Accra, I found these various factors. It didn't take me very long to realise what was happening. And there was undoubtedly a feeling of unease. And if I say that independence was in the air, I don't think I'm exaggerating. The hope for independence was in the air. Now, I have to say something now about what I will call the top brass. We had had a very, very knowledgeable governor of the old school called Sir Alan Burns. He was very knowledgeable indeed. Had he been still governor at the time I'm talking about, 47, 48, I think possibly some of the trouble that ensued might have been avoided. Because Burns was, he really knew what he was doing. He was a first-class governor. Instead, we had had a man called Sir Gerald Creasy. He was a colonial office man, essentially a colonial office man, and he was, I can't remember, I think he was called the Secretary to the West African High Commission, and he operated from Achimota College in Accra, just outside Accra. Now, he was there for some 12 to 15 months, up to the end, I think, or perhaps the middle of 47. I'm not sure what the exact dates are. Sir Gerald was essentially a colonial office man. He'd never been out of the colonial office into any colonial territory, as far as I know. And his thinking would have been essentially that of a desk man in the colonial office. And he would have known Sir Andrew Cohen very well and probably been activated a great deal by Cohen's thinking. I don't know. Because I never really knew Sir Gerald at all until much later, after both of us had finished our service. Anyway, from his job, having spent a year, 15 months, as Secretary to the West African Commission, I think that was what it was called, he was suddenly elevated to become governor of the territory, having had no experience whatever of any other territory or any other governorship. So Sir Gerald was new. So at the start of 48, let us say, when I came down, there were all these factors. There was a new governor who really didn't know the country at all and was new to that sort of position. The chief secretary under him had recently retired, and there was a new chief secretary called Robert Scott. He had come from a very different milieu. He had come from Palestine, where things were totally and utterly different. So he was new as well. The Attorney General was new. So the three men on the top, sitting in Accra, were new. They didn't know local conditions. They hadn't been there long enough to know local conditions. Sir Gerald Creasy, you might say, in his job as Secretary of the West African High Commission, should have had some knowledge in the 12 to 15 months he'd been in office there. But he wasn't the top political man there. So a completely new top brass. Sitting 100 miles away, 125 miles away at Cape Coast, along the coast, towards Takoradi, was a man called Mangin, M-A-N-G-I-N, T-R-O, Mangin. Now, he was, his office was Chief Commissioner of the Colony. Now, Mangin had been in the territory for many years. He knew the Gold Coast extremely well. But he was separated from the governor and from the capital by a distance of 100 to 125 miles. And he was not on the scene. How much he had been able to absorb of the situation in Accra, I have absolutely no idea. Because although I had known Mangin very well indeed, as quite a friend earlier in my service, we're going back to my third tour in the country, which we've missed out at the moment. I never saw Mangin after that time, and I don't know what was in his mind at all, and I don't know how much he knew about the general political situation as it was in Accra at that time. I think he was too far removed to be of any help to the governor. I don't know. I wasn't in those circles to be. I was simply the chief policeman in charge of Accra itself. We had as chief of police a man called Ballantyne. Ballantyne had spent most of his service in Nigeria. He was, I think it is right to say of him, that he was essentially a desk man. He was not a field policeman at all. He was very good on paper. He had got his promotion, I think, over the years through being a good administrative policeman. Field work, I think, was probably not his strong point. He had not long been Commissioner of Police in the Gold Coast. He had come from Nigeria. He'd been sent to Palestine, where he had had a somewhat uneasy time under a tremendous driving force who was the Commissioner of Police there at the time. And it wasn't Spicer by then, it was somebody else. And he didn't fit into the Palestine picture at all, and he was sent back to the West Coast. He came to the Gold Coast in an acting capacity, an acting deputy capacity. In due course, he was made commissioner. I don't think he'd been commissioner for more than a year when he came up to me in the Northern Territories and told me that he wanted me down in Accra. So we had a commissioner who, anyway, he was due to retire. And I think it's perhaps right to say that he wasn't up to the situation that he found.
What capacity were you serving in Accra?
I was serving as a superintendent in charge of Accra. The officers senior to me in Accra at the time were the commissioner himself, Ballantyne, and the deputy, a man called Eccle, who had only just come back from leave. In fact, he came back from leave after Christmas 48. He was he'd been out of the country for about for some 6 months. And although he knew Accra very well and had he'd been spent a lot of his service in Accra, he probably hadn't, by the time he came back, he hadn't appreciated that things were rapidly reaching a point of no return. And there was undoubtedly a crisis on our hands. The third officer senior to me in Accra at the time was a man called Franklin, who was in charge of the CID. Franklin was a policeman all the way through from his service, all the way through his service, and he'd been a good policeman. But he was a very narrow-minded sort of man, and he was afflicted with all sorts of private worries. And I don't think it would be wrong to say he wasn't up to the job by that time. He was having a private feud with the commissioner, which didn't help. And I could get nowhere at all with Franklin. He and I had never really got on particularly well. It was all right, but we had never been particularly close. And I went to Franklin on at least three occasions and tried to tell him that I was perturbed about the situation in Accra, and I tried to put my cards on the table completely, because I wanted him to take it to the commissioner. Franklin wouldn't. He was too busy having his feud with the commissioner, too wrapped up in all sorts of other things which didn't matter at all, and I could get nowhere with him. So I wrote Franklin off, and I went straight to the commissioner. And I told him that at that time I was beginning, I laid my cards completely on the table, and I told him that by that time I was not at all happy about the reliability of the general police, the blue uniform police. I'd had various reasons to feel that way, and I wanted the commissioner to know. The commissioner wouldn't have it.
What reasons had you for feeling anxious about their reliability?
I had built up, I had spent quite a lot of time in Accra in the past, and I had built up quite a lot of local knowledge. I had friends among the Africans. I had my own sources of information. I knew many of the men well, and it was a hunch I had that a number of them had been got at by, let us say, the nationalists. And I was unhappy about it.
What were your sources of information?
Men and women in various grades of life in Accra and outside Accra. It's hard for me now to pinpoint that. It was, but it all added up to a hunch that things were not right. And it was very, very difficult, apart from what I've said to you now over about the obvious causes for discontent, it was very, very difficult to give any specific evidence to the commissioner to support my feeling of disquiet. Anyway, we had the boycott on our hands, the trade boycott that I talked about, on our hands. That was causing quite a lot of bother. We tried to bring one case to court where some of these hitmen had been apprehended, but we couldn't persuade the witnesses to come forward and give their evidence. They were frightened. There was an atmosphere of fear. Kwame Nkrumah was pervading everybody with his ability to speak and to sway the masses. Then I was in touch with an excellent man called Colonel Whitcomb. Colonel Whitcomb had fought and led units of the West African Brigade in East Africa and Burma. He had been, before the war, he had been a territorial officer, and he knew the West African Brigade, the men of the West African Brigade, the ex-soldiers, very well indeed. And if anybody had done anything for the West Africans on their return back to rehabilitate them, Whitcomb had worked himself to the bone, doing what he could for them. They knew him, and he knew them. And Whitcomb told me that there was general air of disquiet and disappointment among the West Africans. The West African soldiers, the ex-soldiers. And I believed him, and I'm quite sure he was right. We talked a lot about this. I also talked quite a lot to the very young district commissioner, a man called Moxon, James Moxon. Now, James Moxon is still around. James Moxon is in Ghana, and after independence, which eventually came, James Moxon became an African chief. He still is an African chief. I see him occasionally. I've seen him during this last year. But at this time we're talking about, he was a young district commissioner in Accra. It's possible that he was too young to hold the job, but anyway, he had it. He says himself that he was too young to hold the job. But he and I talked quite a lot about my own feelings about it. And to some extent, he shared my feelings. A number of times, I went to the commissioner to try to get him to understand what was going on. He didn't want to understand. There's no shadow of doubt he didn't want to. His own time was coming to an end. He was due to retire. And I fear that it was a question of peace in our time, O Lord. His deputy, Eckel, large, fat, nice, thoroughly nice, went along with Ballantyne. But I think he had private reservations. In fact, I'm sure he did. What he said to Ballantyne without my being there, I don't know. However, the time arrived, when the ex-servicemen wished to hold a procession. And this was the crux that led to the boil over, the whole thing. The organisers of the procession came to Ballantyne's office and said they wanted to take a petition to Government House, to the governor. I was called in as the senior superintendent in charge of Accra, and I was asked my views about it, and Ballantyne and I, and Eccle, the deputy, who, as I said, had only just come back from leave, we all three agreed that under no circumstances must a procession go anywhere near a Government House, where they hoped to present their petition to Sir Gerald Creasy, who was there with his wife. Instead, Ballantyne said to the organisers, no, you can't go to Government House. We won't give you a permit for that, but we will give you a permit to hold your procession and for you to go to the Secretariat, which was off the line of approach to Government House, and there you can hand in your petition to a senior administrative officer, and we have already made arrangements for him to be there to meet you, to take your petition, and he will see to it that Sir Gerald Creasy receives it straight away. So that was the arrangement.
Was that agreed to by the organisers?
That was agreed to by the organisers. And this was 2 days before the procession was due to be held.
Which month was this in?
This was February 1948 by this time. It was a Saturday. The meeting in Ballantyne's office was Thursday the 26th of February. The procession itself was due to be held on Saturday the 28th. Now, Saturday the 28th was significant also because arrangements had finally been made on a top level for the trade boycott to be called off. The trade people, the UAC and the European and Syrian traders, Lebanese traders, had all agreed to reduce prices, and this had been broadcast round the place, and the boycott was due to be lifted on the Saturday morning. And so on the Saturday morning of the projected procession, everything would return to normal in the shops, and there'd be no longer any boycott. So the scene was set for the meeting on Saturday morning, the procession on Saturday morning, no trade boycott, and procession to go to the Secretariat, where a very senior government officer would meet the procession and would take the petition to Sir Gerald Creasy. As the superintendent in charge of Accra, I was, by law, bound to give a petition.